you know, the people who think that X-ray will solve everything. We have customers that say, we need to X-ray the whole board, every board we produce. And I tell them, well, if you think you can't, you have to inspect at that level everything you make, you should look at your manufacturing process first, because you shouldn't be having to inspect that much. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have people who are amazed by what X-ray can produce and can deliver, especially as we evolve in creating the bridge between data and information, right? So not only we can produce data and spill out images, but we can also produce information. So insights on the manufacturing process and where that specific problem that we see with the X-ray image might have happened, right? So if it's a printing issue, a reflow issue, or pick and place issue, we can say, hey, go back to your printer and make sure that that stencil was properly cleaned or maybe there's a damage on the stencil itself that has to be addressed.
That's my guest, Dr. Bill Cardoso, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Bill started his first company in Brazil at age 17 and sold it a few years later to move to the U.S. to work for the Department of Energy's Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory to do nuclear and high-energy physics research. As the department head for systems engineering, and after a 10-year-long career at Fermi Lab, he moved from Chicago to Southern California to start Creative Electron from his garage. Bill was what could be described as an early achiever, earning his associate's degree at age 13. Bill earned a Bachelor's of Science in Electrical and Computer Engineering from the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul, and a Master's of Science and a PhD from the Illinois Institute of Technology, and, if that weren't enough, an MBA from the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Here's my conversation with Dr. Bill Cardoso. Bill Cardoso, welcome to Reliability Matters. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure to be here.
I'm glad you're here. So you and I share two things in common. Number one, we both started our businesses out of our garage.
Yeah.
And we both had really bad timing when we started our businesses.
Or great timing.
Well,
right?
It turned out great. It turned out great. But I started my business in 1992. And It's important to note, for those who don't know, we build cleaning machines that clean circuit boards. And right in 1992 was the very beginning of a new technology called no clean flux that doesn't have to be cleaned. So we started coming out with cleaning machines as people were switching to a technology that did not require cleaning machines. So go figure. But if you start at zero, you start at zero.
Exactly.
Even if you're like minus 10, you're down in the well. But it took a while to get up to the ground surface, and eventually, cleaning became quite mainstream again. Tell me about your experience. 2008, I think you started.
2008, yeah, the biggest recession or depression in history. Now, let me ask you something. How long before your wife kicked you out from the garage?
About a year or so. She kind of gave me an ultimatum. Find a building or find a new wife. And I paused for a moment, but no, it was an easy decision. We found a building, and we started that whole progression. I'm sure you've been there, where you start with a little 1,200 square foot, 1,100 square foot multi-tenant business park, and then you get the unit next to you and knock a hole in the wall, and then you get the unit next to that, and eventually you move, and you start climbing the real estate ladder.
Exactly. Yeah, when you get to five or six. In your company is a maze, right? And employees get lost going from one switch to the next.
Yeah.
So you move to a bigger building. Yeah. In my case, it was about three, four months after I started in the garage that my wife told me, you know what? I think it's time for you to get a building. And it worked out really well. I think made the right choice and stayed with the wife instead of keeping the business in the garage. For us, it was a It's an interesting time, right? 2008 was a time where a lot of companies were shrinking, right? They were laying off people because business had basically disappeared. I mean, for those that are listening to us, they're too young to remember 2008. It was a massive crash in the real estate market that shook the financial infrastructure of this country to its core. So it was hard to get a loan. Everything was hard, right? And the good side of starting a business in the middle of a crisis, and we're in the middle of a crisis right now with this pandemic. So people listening who might be thinking about starting a business and they think it's too hard, well, look for opportunities, right? Disruptions always create gaps that if you can identify them, you can be very successful servicing customers that might right now be neglected by established businesses, right? And that's the gap that we're able to find. Once established businesses at the time were in distress, customers were no longer, they couldn't receive the level of service that they were used to. And that's where we filled in. You know, we started in a small, at the time, it was a fairly small niche in counterfeit detection, developing machines, you know, to find fake components, fake electronic components. And then from there, we were able to really service the market really well. And we still work with a lot of, we still do a lot of counterfeit detection. And then from there, we're able to go to electronics, PCB inspection, and, you know, keep growing from there. And like what I like to say, right, Mike, when your market share is 0%, it's very easy to grow 1,000% a year, right?
Exactly. Oh, your first sale is an amazing statistic, right?
It's
you
infinite.
Go from zero to infinite one. It's infinite. Yeah, exactly. And then your second sale, you've doubled your sales.
Doubled, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. Growing a business is not for the faint at heart. I often say when I'm asked to speak to like students and things like that about entrepreneurship, that it takes a set of very specific skill sets to start a business from nothing. And that includes arrogance, ignorance, ego, naivety, luck, and money. And usually money's not part of it.
Exactly,
so,
yeah.
But you do have to have this sense of naivety, a very beginner's mindset in order to start a business. And you also have to have a very terrible assessment of risk.
Yeah.
70% of all businesses fail within 10 years. 25% fail year one, 50% fail year five. Mm-hmm. So if that were a table game in Las Vegas, you would never sit at it. Even, no matter how many free drinks they give you, you will never sit at that game because, you know, that's terrible odds. But, you know, some come out the other end, not a low percentage, but definitely some come out of the other end. And you're one of those. That's why I want to talk to you. You're a relatively new business for this industry.
Yeah.
But, you know, the interesting thing is to me anyway, you know this already, you are one of the very few, probably only two categories of technologies in the electronic assembly space that is a very old technology. You are only beaten in the age of your technology by solder, right? Because solder goes back to a couple thousand years ago, right? They in the Bronze Age and whatever age it was where we learned how to meld metals together. In your industry's case, your technology was actually discovered in 1895 by Wilhelm Röntgen. And, you know, he was tooling around with all these different frequencies, and he found a wavelength that they now call X-ray, which earned him the Nobel Peace Prize in physics in 1901. Ooh. So 1890, your technology goes back to 1895. And I don't think Pick and Place can say that. That probably goes back to the early 70s or something, 1970s. So tell me, since the industry, the technology in your industry has been around for so long, most people think of X-ray, if you're a civilian, not in this industry. You might think of X-ray as basically just dental X-rays and medical X-rays when you get your teeth checked or you think you've broken a bone. But X-ray is commonly used to for the inspection of inorganic materials, including, in our industry, electrical components and circuit assemblies. So walk me through the progression of X-ray technology in the modern age. You know, obviously, we're not back in 1895. Walk me through, since you kind of got involved in this industry, what's changed? Where were we? Where are we? Where are we going with X-ray?
Yeah, so you're talking to one of the biggest X-ray geeks out there, right? We have a museum downstairs of X-ray instruments and X-ray equipment from, 100 plus years. We have in the old days, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and early 50s, you could find an X-ray machine at a shoe store, right? To make sure that your shoe was properly fit to your toes. They were actually live X-ray, your feet with the new shoes to make sure that, it was a proper fit. So we have those machines downstairs, and we have a bunch of other things that I've been collecting over the years.
People actually put their foot in an X-ray machine in a shoe store?
In a shoe store.
Back in the day? Wow.
Back in the day. It was very powerful. To give you an idea, an X-ray source for an X-ray machine for electronics, maybe it's 10 watts, 15 watts of power. Those machines were 700 watts with no shielding whatsoever, Mike. It was just a piece of wood separating the source to the victim or the customer.
I was guessing it's good for the oncology business, right? Eventually.
Yeah,
that's terrible.
Just incredible. So we have all these things downstairs because I love the history, right? I love how much this industry has progressed, especially in the safety perspective, right? We've learned a lot, especially with the early pioneers who, sacrificed a lot to teach us, to show the limits of safety using X-ray inspection. That's why machines today have multiple interlocks. They are shielded, fully shielded, so there's no leakage coming out of the machine. And so from the early days, from Röntgen's, 1895 discovery to today, quite a bit has been done on the X-ray source, for example. So we have better resolution with micro and nanofocus X-ray sources. We have better sensors with, better and better digital flat panel sensors that can get incredible images. And over the past, 10 to 15 years, once, Google, Facebook, and Amazon started developing heavily artificial intelligence and increase the computing power available to all of us. That is now allowing us to take advantage of that research and bring a lot of artificial intelligence and machine learning to our X-ray systems. And that's what I think is going to be the biggest breakthrough going forward for the electronics industry, that will allow us to go from automated systems that can take images on their own to fully autonomous machines that can fully understand what the sample, what your board looks like, and is capable of finding defects, without an operator having to teach the machine what you do. So the machine will already know what you do and will do that all autonomously.
Yeah, it can make some discernments. We'll talk about AI in a little bit, artificial intelligence in a little bit. But I do remember when bottom terminated components first came on the scene, in particular BGAs, where you have all these connections underneath a part that you can't see. The technology of the day, even though X-ray was around, the popular technology back then in those early days of BGAs was basically, a microscope with an oblique angle viewer. It would turn the optical view 90 degrees and peer under a component. But really, all you saw back then was 180 degrees of the outside of the balls, and you couldn't see anything inside. I don't know people spent a lot of money on those machines and couldn't see beyond the second row. So X-ray seemed like a really good fit for that. So am I correct in assuming that the production, the release of bottom terminated components was a jumping off point for X-ray? I'm sure there was X-ray in our industry before the bottom terminated components, but that probably normalized it and made it more conventional wisdom for inspection, because otherwise you can't see under those things. I think people had to get X-ray. And it, was that kind of the defining moment for X-ray in the electronic assembly industry space?
Yeah, absolutely. The I would even go a bit further to say that bottom terminated components made the X-ray industry as we know today. Right, prior to BGAs, prior to BTC, bottom terminated components, BTCs, X-ray use in the electronics industry was, I'm not going to say spotty, but it was all over the place, right? A lot of custom machines looking at connectors, through-hole via inserts. So it wasn't really well-defined. And you know, prior to the BGA revolution, you'd find that X-ray machines were fairly customized for each customer. So an X-ray company like ours would make a machine for company A and another machine for company B and so on and so forth. Once BGA was established as the standard package for a lot of active components, it activated our ability as an X-ray company to make one standard machine and sell hundreds and thousands of times, right? So with that, we it really created a market for X-ray systems that we didn't have before. You know, similar to airport scanners, where one airport scanner can be used in, you know, 1,000 different airports around the world. Now we have one X-ray machine that can be used in 1,000 EMS companies around the world. And they all are looking at the same well-conceived problem, right? It's a bunch of balls under a package that you need to look for voids, shorts, opens, heading pillow, cracks, and any other assembly issues you might have.
Let's play Mythbusters for a second.
Awesome. I love that show.
Yeah, me too. Are there any common misconceptions of X-ray or and or its capabilities? In other words, do people say, we have this problem, X-ray will solve everything, and it doesn't? Or they think they don't need X-ray when they really do? What are the, bust some of those myths for me.
Yeah, so we get all of those, as a matter of fact. We have the, you know, the people who think that X-ray will solve everything. We have customers that say, oh yeah, we're making all the, we need to X-ray everything. We need to X-ray the whole board, every board we produce. And I tell them, well, if you think you can't, you have to inspect at that level everything you make, you should look at your manufacturing process first, because you shouldn't be having to inspect that much. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have people who are amazed by what X-ray can, you know, can produce and can deliver, especially as we evolve in creating the bridge between data and information, right? So not only we can produce data and spill out images, but we can also produce information. So insights on the manufacturing process and where that specific problem that we see with the X-ray image might have happened, right? So if it's a printing issue, a reflow issue, or a pick and place issue, we can say, hey, go back to your printer and make sure that that stencil was properly cleaned, or properly, or maybe there's a damage on the stencil itself that has to be addressed. We also have issues with the understanding of the technology itself, right? And the boundaries of what X-ray can do in 2D or 3D, right? That 1D between 2 and 3D is a very, very...
That's a costly D. Yeah.
Very costly D, exactly. It's a big gap between two-dimensional X-ray and three-dimensional X-ray. And they come to us and say, oh, I really need 3D. And we probe a little bit and we figure out that they actually need is just a tilted view of the sample to look at, you know, side view of the BGAs, and that misunderstanding can cost, you know, $100,000 to $200,000 easily. So, what we, and that's one of the reasons why when I set up the company, I wanted to have extremely capable and trained people talking to our customers, right? So there are no smoke and mirrors. There's no, this sleazy sales pitch. We want it to be as technical and as education as possible, right? So we can have a conversation, a good conversation with the customers, and really guide them through what they really need for the application, right? So you don't buy one thing, you don't buy a Ferrari to go to, get lumber at Home Depot, because that's not going to work for you.
No, right? No, it wouldn't.
On the other hand, you don't want to buy
a lumber.
You want to buy a F-250 to go on an Autobahn, right?
Right. Right. No, it's the right machine for the right application. You know, you said something interesting. You said finding something, to paraphrase loosely, if you're finding too many defects or something wrong. So it really, if you're inspecting to search for defects, there's probably something wrong with your process. If you're inspecting to confirm conformance and reliability, then there's probably not a lot wrong with your process. But if you think you need any kind of inspection machine to find all the mistakes, probably before you buy the machine, you ought to work on your process a little bit so that you can use the inspection equipment to just validate conformance rather than hunting for defects. Is there such thing as seeing too much? You know, we went so many years without seeing behind the curtain that X-ray lets us do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can they have too much resolution? Can someone suddenly buy a piece of X-ray equipment and get the results and then freak out, even though nothing's changed? You know, or is there such thing as an over concern created by the way someone's interpreting the results of an X-ray image?
Yeah, it's actually a very, very good question, because it does happen. It does happen where, and especially customers that had a legacy and older machine that produced, it was a great image quality at the time. And now, as we discussed, sources and sensors got much better. So the image quality has evolved greatly. So now when they see a new image and they see, before they didn't have any voids, now they have a bunch of voids on their pads. And they look at the two images and say, oh, wow, our process got much worse. Well, now you can see what you're producing, right? So we're not adding any information to your samples. We're just displaying what's in there. So it's a process of calibrating expectations, right, from our customers, and especially our customers' customers, who oftentimes receive those images and freak out because now all of a sudden the process went to, to the garbage and has to be upgraded. So it's not. I mean, everything is working fine. Now we can see what you're really producing. So truth hurts sometimes, Mike.
Truth is painful. Yeah. Reminds me of that Tom Cruise movie, You Can't Handle the Truth.
Can't Handle the Truth, yes.
So let's talk about AI for a second, artificial intelligence. It's, I think for a lot of industries, it's a buzzword and not much more. Right. I think for your industry, it's meaningful. Tell me about how artificial intelligence has made its way into X-ray and what kind of benefits AI provides someone interpreting an X-ray image.
Yeah, so AI has been incredible. It really has. We're talking about the type of AI that's very specific, right? It's artificial intelligence engine that we train to do very, very narrow, very specific things. And that's important for people to understand that, so that, they don't think we are talking about this, the big brother AI that people are afraid of, that's going to replace humans and take over the world. That's all we're talking about.
Right. You don't teach it to look at an X-ray image and suddenly it learns how to play chess.
Exactly.
It's within a box.
I wish you could do that. That company that did that, remember, with the game Go, actually sold to Google for what, $300+ million. So, I wouldn't mind being able to do that by accident, but
right.
Let me give an example where AI works beautifully. We have a customer that makes, they repair iPhones, right? So they refurb iPhones. So you drop your phone on the toilet and you send it back to AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and get a new one. So your old broken phone ends up with these guys. They're going to open your phone, clean it up, repair it, close it, and then ship it back to the phone company to be sold as a refurb unit. Now, once in a while, the operator that's closing the phone is going to forget to put a screw, or is going to not attach the screw properly, and you end up with a loose screw inside, or is going to place the wrong battery on the phone. So a lot of these issues that that can happen and have happened, which cause the end customer to be very upset, you know, because the refurb phone doesn't work as it should. So this is one problem. You can say, okay, let's take an X-ray, and right before it ships back to the phone company, and we'll find any mistakes. Now, how do you classify any possible mistake an operator can make? It's very hard, right? So if you're going to design an algorithm that's going to find any possible issue, it becomes very complicated because you have to account for any possible variation of issues that can happen. With AI, it allows us to run an algorithm, and we train them to look and see what a good phone looks like. So we train and say, this is a good phone. And we put, you know, 20, 30, 50 images of what a good phone looks like. Then anything that doesn't look like that is going to be flagged as an issue, right? So if it's a missing screw, if it's a loose screw, if it's wrong battery, wrong control board, wrong camera, any of these issues will be flagged as a potential problem. So that's one case where AI is really the only solution to a, it's difference between a well-conceived problem and an ill-conceived problem, right? Well-conceived problems where you can, you know, draw a box around the problem, and you, it's very well defined, and you know how to solve it. BGAs, you have the balls, you have voids inside the balls. If the balls are touching, it's a short, very well defined problem, well conceived problem. An ill conceived problem is one where you don't really know what's going to happen, right? It's, it can be a bunch of different things and a combination of them, and that's where, you know, going back to that example, the game of Go could only be automated using AI, right? Chess is a well-conceived problem. And the combinatorics in chess are much, much smaller than the game of Go, which are, I mean, they're more plays than the number of stars in the universe, right?
Right. Chess is not an infinite variety of moves. It is a defined amount.
Yeah, you can train a computer, you know, like the
HAL. What's IBM's? Yeah. Watson.
Watson, yes. Yeah. And now we
HAL's the guy that HAL's the computer that kept the guy in Space Odyssey, you know, wanted to shut down. HAL was like the scary side of artificial intelligence back in 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
Watson's the chess player. Yeah. So, you know, we talk about AI interpreting results, which is great because it takes the human error factor out of it. And AI just gets smarter. It doesn't get dumber. You know, you build on it. But are there, you know, when I think of the medical uses of X-ray, you know, there are an entire field of specialists, radiologists, that will examine an X-ray image. Even the doctor who orders, or maybe a CAT scan is a better example, or an MRI, it's a digital image. And even the doctor that prescribes it isn't the person generally that interprets it. It's interpreted by someone with a lot of training and a special degree. Are there instances where even the best AI still requires a human to discern what the AI has pronounced the defect to be? You know, can AI be tricked? Is a human eye ultimately maybe not as good at redundant repetitive things, because we tend to, you know, if there's always a screw in hole number three, and then suddenly there's not, you know, human nature is to just see a screw in hole number three, right? Because they're used to it, where AI will catch that. But are there instances where it still comes down to the human to make that final decision, and a human is better at AI in certain instances?
Yeah, so that's it's an interesting question. Let me try to unpack it, because it's a very powerful question. And there are two aspects that come to mind right now. One is exhaustion, right? Humans can look at images for about 15 to 20 minutes before they get bored, tired, and they just start spacing out, right? So if you have someone looking at images, any images, X-ray images or optical images, infrared, doesn't matter. If you have someone looking at those images for a longer period of time, you end up having a quickly reduction in their ability to catch things, right? And that's been studied by, you know, lots of different researchers, and it's something that, you know, happens, especially nowadays with cell phones. You know, you watch, you're looking at images for 10, 15 minutes before you know you're looking at Facebook and Instagram, and, you know, things start passing and you don't catch anymore. So that's one thing. AI and other computer algorithms, they don't get distracted, right? They're going to perform as well as in minute one as in minute, you know, 5,000. There is a recent research by Stanford Medical School, and they were looking at the ability of radiologists to catch issues with X-ray images versus AI-trained algorithms, engines, to find in looking at the same batch of images. And what they found is that, if I remember correctly, the physicians were in the 92-93%
accuracy
and the probability of finding, you know, what the issue was. AI was in the 90-91%. So lower than a human, but, you know, getting close. But if you add both,
AI only gets smarter, right? Humans exactly. don't always get smarter. History tells us that. But AI
but if you combine builds both, on it. They were in the 97%. So that ability of combining an algorithm, right, and using that to assist a human to perform better is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And that's something that AI engines use regularly to improve is by, and that's the machine learning part of it, is you learn what the humans are doing, how they are making decisions, and in using that to improve in their accuracy.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Very interesting discussion there. I am familiar with that article. That was the genesis for the question. It was surprising to me that it still came down to humans, but I give it time. I give it time, and I think Hal and Watson will catch up. So, you know, when I think of X-ray in our industry, I think of inspections of the integrity of solder connections underneath bottom terminal components. But I know it has other applications too. And I saw a interview with you recently where you were talking about parts counter. Mm-hmm. You know, typically when you think of a parts counter, you think of two reels and some kind of optical device or magnetic device or whatever in between the two reels. And, you know, parts spin from one reel to the other and the parts are physically counted with this detector. Tell me about the X-ray version of a parts counter. Explain the differences to me.
Yeah, so that's it's an interesting application of X-rays. And it's fairly intuitive, right? So instead of unreeling from one, components from one reel and reeling back in another reel, and then you have to bring it, you know, to original reel after you're done. And most of these manual counters or even the automated counters that do this process, they are counting basically the holes on the tape, right? And you put the pitch and it kind of assesses how many components are in the reel. The X-ray parts counter, instead, you don't have to open the reel at all, right? You put the reel, can even be sealed flat on a stage, and there is a big detector, it's usually 17 by 17 inches, that can take an image of the whole reel in one shot. And then we have an algorithm that counts the little blobs, right? Each blob is a component. So you count how many blobs are in the image, and you have your counts right there. So it's faster, right? It can count in a matter of seconds instead of minutes. You don't have to open the reel, so you don't have the the risk of losing components or damage the tape, right? Which is all those parts have, and The only problem, of course, is price. It's expensive. It's much more expensive than one of those old style counters. So X-ray parts counters, they don't work for everyone, right? If you're counting a couple of reels a day, by all means, use a manual.
Right.
Don't waste your time with an X-ray because you're not going to get your return investment anytime soon. But if a lot of EMS companies, when they do countbacks, right, when they bring reels back before they put in inventory, it's beneficial for them to understand how many components they're actually putting back in inventory. Because what happens from time to time, that's one of the reasons we developed this machine. What happens from time to time, they think they have 1,000, 100 nanofarad capacitors in stock, and they actually have 900. And they find that out halfway through the run. And in that process, they end up with line stoppage. With the shortage of components we have, and looking at lead times in the 30, 40 weeks like we had before, I don't know how they're doing right now, but I can't imagine any better. That became a big issue and a big pain. And then with the pain comes the motivation to make that investment.
Is there such thing as a miracle X-ray machine that can be used, the same box can be used to inspect under BGAs and be used to count components on reels? Or are they so different in the internal workings that they have to be separate boxes?
You know, that's, you just described the Swiss Army knife, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The Swiss Army knife does everything, but it doesn't do anything well, right?
True.
It's
if
not
you ever tried
knife.
To turn a screw with the screwdriver attachment, it's awful. Yeah,
exactly.
I hear you. Or the little tiny scissors, the little tiny miniature Barbie scissors that come with it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, there are Swiss Army X-ray machines that can count parts and look at BGAs, but they're not going to do anything well.
Right.
It's going to be like a Swiss Army knife. It's going to be limited on everything you do.
It's in your back pocket, but you're not cutting down trees with it.
You're not cutting down trees, and you're not, it gets you by, and you might be able to survive an audit, right?
Right.
But it's not gonna get out.
Well, sometimes people buy equipment, particularly inspection equipment, just to point to it when the auditors come by. They don't actually use it. They just point to it. Say, yeah, check off the list. You know, and we're benefactors of that. You know, we sell cleanliness testing inspection equipment, and I'm convinced some of our customers, very few, but some of them I don't think ever plug it in. It's just there to satisfy a checkbox on some audit list. Hey, this is a little off topic, but I saw an interview with you where you said something that just resonated with me because we do the same thing, although not quite as literally as you do. You talked about your supply chain, and you have reduced geographically your supply chain down to a 600-mile range. All the parts you buy for your equipment, you acquire it from vendors no more than 600 miles away. That is an amazingly tight supply chain. Tell me the motivation behind that and what kind of benefit that provides Creative Electron.
I know you went through the same process, right? When you're starting a company and you have choices, right? Then you can... And as an entrepreneur, right, you have the option and you have the choice to optimize several different things in your company. One of them is cost of goods sold, right? So your COGS, you can say, you know what, I'm going to trim my COGS as much as I can. And one of the ways you can do that, you can, for example, go to Asia and get, in our case, we much like you do, is we have cabinets, right? Big cabinets, they're heavy, expensive. And, we could have said, you know what, we're going to go to China and we buy a bunch of cabinets at a time and we import them at a lower price. Or you can say, you know what, I'm originally from Brazil, right? U.S., I know it sounds corny, but this is a country that I migrated to in the late 90s and gave me a lot of opportunities. So to have a local supply chain where we create local jobs, right? We put money back in our community. We grow with our city and our families and schools, et cetera, means something to me, right? Means It's the very, very, very small way that I have to give back. Could I make more money by making other options? Absolutely. Yeah, we could be more profitable by, as I said before, we can go to China and buy cabinets at half the price. But we choose not to do so because, you know, I have this belief that, you know, in my case, I want to give back to our local community. So we keep things local. So the sheet metal, lead, the frame and all the other pieces that we have, we look at partners and people around us who can help us. The other benefit of having that, other than, you know, the good feeling of giving back to your community, is that you have control over things, right? And not only that, we can change things on a dime. And a lot of our customers have needs that not necessarily comply with the box that we have on the shelf, right? They need a little different. They need a sample that's a little bigger than we can support. So we by having a local supply chain, we can work with people around us and change and modify and customize as needed. It doesn't cost us a whole bunch extra because we don't have to go back and, you know, redesign the whole thing and buy 100 cabinets. We can customize one or two. So with that, we need to have, you know, we have designers in-house, mechanical designers, electrical designers, electronics. We have software team in-house. So we keep everything in-house so that we can, you know, turn on a dime and respond as needed by our customers, which are very, you know, much like your customers, Mike, you know, they're very demanding. You know, they want things done yesterday, right?
Sure. If not before. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what it comes to us, right? I mean, that's the only reason I can justify having an X-ray company in San Diego, Mike. Otherwise, right? Doesn't make any sense.
That's right.
Exactly. If you don't have the ability to customize and meet absolutely insane demands from your customer, you shouldn't be in San Diego. You shouldn't be in California, right?
Right.
You know that well.
Right. Yeah. Go to some flyover part of the country and get a little shed there and build there if you were just in it for that. I think there's a big difference between cost and value, and the lowest cost is rarely the highest value, you know. And we went through the same metamorphosis. We started off buying everything locally, and then we, you know, as we started scaling, you know, we went overseas to acquire certain parts. You know, everything is built in the U.S. and California, but we would, you know, we were chasing the needle, you know, the profit needle. And then we scaled everything back and we said, no. We clawed back our supply chain. And, you know, now we buy locally whenever possible. And our edict is we buy from someone next door. If there's no one next door, we go down to the next block. If there's no one down the next block, we go to the next city, then maybe the next state. And, you know, we really try to build locally, and we're not the automobile industry, you know, or the airline industry. There's this old adage. It's probably not true, but the old adage was that American Airlines one day took the olives out of the martinis, in first class and saved $1 million a year on fuel, you know, and that's probably not true, but, but the point is we're not scaled like an American Airlines or a General Motors, you know, if it costs us a few hundred dollars more a machine, that's no big deal. You know, and we don't sell by price. I don't think you do either. We sell by value. Someone has a problem. We have a solution. What's it worth? You know, and, you know, we don't discount generally. We stand firm on our prices and we think our prices are fair. And we don't attract people who are looking for sales. And if we can maintain a modest profit structure so that we can be around to service customers over the next decade or two, then we attract customers who are looking for value and not cost. And it works well that way. And then you can afford to build businesses in build equipment in San Diego and purchase locally when you can save 20% if you purchased it overseas. But you get a better product, you get a better relationship with your vendor, you get better support from your vendor than you do someone, you know, on email from Alibaba, right?
So yeah, exactly. It's a process, right, Mike, that you have to go through as a business owner to understand that not all customers are your customers, right?
That's right. Well, that takes a while to get to that stage. That's not the way I started the business. I thought everyone was my customer.
But, exactly. Anyone with some money in their pocket,
exactly.
Right? You want to serve them. You got to work out a way to make it happen. But then you realize that, I have no problem telling when we talk to customers, like, if you're looking for the absolute cheapest piece of equipment, we are not it. Let me give you some Alibaba links. And, go at it, right?
Yeah.
Go at it. Knowing what the pros and cons are, which is, you know, service, quality, et cetera, but you have to meet those customers that who value, they have some shared values, right? And understand that they want to buy a piece of equipment that's going to be around for 10 years instead of, you know, 10 weeks, right? And, and there's everything out there, and their customers are looking for, you know, the box in the corner that can point you and say, "Hey, we have that." Which, by the way, Mike, there are companies companies overseas that sell you the cabinet of an X-ray machine, just the cabinet, for about $500 to $1,000.
Wow!
Just the cabinet, right? Nothing inside. It's completely empty inside. And those are cabinets that you put in a corner just for audits. People walk by and say, "Oh, look, I have one right there."
It is.
See?
Yeah. Don't make me turn it on.
Don't make me turn it on. Oh wow, the guy who knows how to operate it. Oh, he's taking a day off today, so he can't turn it on. Sorry.
Yeah, that's funny.
But there's everything out there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Going back to your comments on price and our discussion on price, I find that people who pay the least expect the most.
Yeah.
And
they're very expensive customers.
And they're not partners. They're demanding. But people who don't lead with price, people who lead with problem solution, generally our relationship with those customers are more partner based. Even if there is a problem with the equipment, they work with us, they help us, they give us advice, and recommendations, and we're in it together. And that seems to be a much better relationship than someone who just, you know, put you through the mill and beat you up on price and you know, high five, they paid 30% less than the next guy. But and then all of a sudden they're very demanding. money on them, but you have to service them for the next several years. So
exactly. You know, our company wouldn't be, and I'm sure you can say the same, our company wouldn't be what it is today without some really amazing customers.
Absolutely.
Who helped us, right?
Absolutely.
Through the process. And what's interesting is that they got, you know, a lot of value from us as well, because they got a product that doesn't exist in the market anywhere else, right?
Right.
Because we're able to develop with them solutions that really cater to their needs and solve their pain, which they wouldn't be able to find anywhere else, right? Just buying a box that does what it does, and it is, right? There's no other options.
So, Bill, what are your predictions over the next 1 to 5 years for our industry, for your industry, for our general industry at large? Where do you see us going?
It's a timely question, right? I mean, if you had asked me this 6 months ago, the question
whole different
was,
answer.
Exactly, different.
Whole different answer, right? So, clearly, 5 years from now, God willing, we're out of this pandemic. You know, this is a blip on the big screen radar, but. Including the whole pandemic thing, where do you think we're going to, how are we going to do through that? How much longer do you think it's going to last and impact business? And then where do you see us going after this?
Let me start focusing on the positives, right, of this experience.
Awesome.
Right. And I know people like to talk about the negatives, but let's talk about the positives. We've been, as an industry, talking about automation. We've been talking about Industry 4.0 ad nauseum for how long now?
Long time.
This opportunity, right, this pandemic has allowed us to just start bringing to reality a lot of these conversations, right? So a lot of the theoretical academic conversations we had about, you can take the images, put them in the cloud, get them analyzed, bring results back. They're all very theoretical. Now people need them all of a sudden, right? Now the pain arrived. Ideally, the pain would have arrived slowly, right? But no, it came as a ton of bricks in people's heads. So, but that, a lot of opportunities are created in that process. The other, I'm sure you're going through the same process with your company, is this results-oriented workplace that we are living right now, right? Where you work and when you work became irrelevant, right? You can work from home, from the sure. park, from coffee, or from the office. And as long as you produce, as long as you're hitting your objectives, we're happy with it. So think maybe 10 years or 15 years of progress, Mike, were shrunk into 6 months, right? Mm-hmm. And that has created a lot of very interesting opportunities for us. Customers that wouldn't talk to us before are now coming to us and saying, hey, do you remember that thing you talked about a year ago? Can we have it now?
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about it. Yeah. Let's make this happen, right? So once you kick that this rock of progress, it keeps them rolling and getting momentum, right? And for the next 5 years, I see a continuum. So when this COVID, this pandemic eases up and we have a vaccine and we're back to whatever normal looks like, a lot of these conversations are not going to stop. They're going to keep progressing. Sure. Because people in our generation, right, in our positions, they're always going to have in the back of their minds those weeks and months we had to shut down, right? And we had to disrupt our manufacturing because of COVID. We're always going to be thinking about, oh, what's the next one? It's almost like those generations, right, Mike? The great generation, Second World War, First World War, they always, they became hoarders and no one knows why. Yeah. Yeah, because you've gone through a very traumatic event and now you're preparing for it.
Yeah. I've talked with friends about that. We are now the generation that our grandkids will kind of make fun of because we'll be washing our hands more frequently than anyone else. My dad, was, and I'm sure your family, your parents were products of that last generation.
Yeah,
that,
exactly.
My dad carried around a little coin purse, for lack of a better word. It's like a wallet that held coins. Uh-huh. And if he went to pay for something and it was $9.96, it's like, yeah. Oh, hold on. He'd open up his coin purse and hand out, dimes and nickels and quarters and pennies. And everything was saved, right?
Because
he came out of that, World War II generation where you couldn't take for granted that money would be there the next week, right?
Exactly. So I think it's going to be very productive for us as an industry to kick us into, fifth gear towards Industry 4.0 to get to realize some of these concepts we've been toying around forever now with digital twins and allows us to make that progress, right? Travel. Do you remember, Mike, how much travel we did before?
I vaguely remember these long silver tubes we would sit in and
I know.
And remember go that? Really fast and go high. Travel.
Yeah. Customers had to see us, right? Now we have Zoom, we have GoToMeeting, we have WebEx. So that barrier just broke down.
Absolutely.
Right?
So much more efficient, really. And
much more efficient. You can have a conversation with a customer, very nice interface, and have dinner with your family, right?
Sure. Yeah, it's the best of all worlds. It's really win-win. Yeah, I think we're going to come out of this. I agree with you. I think we're going to come out of this with a new perspective on business. I think travel will come back, not to maybe the same level it did, or for different reasons. But, to fly 3,000 miles to tell a person how an X-ray tube works.
Exactly.
You can actually be more productive sharing your screen, showing them all the collateral, the technical specs, all that. Hey, last question. We have to wrap up because we're almost out of time. But I wanted to get your gauge on this. I'm starting to ask this to more and more guests. You and I both started a business out of our garage. What would you say to budding entrepreneurs? Since there are people right now who have lost their jobs, there are certain industries that are not coming back or people that will not be going back to work. This is a time when people are reflecting on their careers. And maybe people have had this dream in the back of their head that they've kept pushing back about jumping into the business themselves. So what would you say to these budding entrepreneurs who express a desire to take a leap of faith and start a new business? What's your advice?
Life is way too short to do something you don't like to do. So if you do have a passion, if you do have something in the back of your mind, just go ahead and do it. Because the one thing you know very well, Mike, as an entrepreneur, you know, unlike a 9-to-5 job, when you go home, you don't turn off from the business, right? It's with you 24/7. And I'm not just saying that because it is a reality. It is your life. It becomes, it consumes you. So if you're going to be consumed by something, it better be something you really like and enjoy doing, right? Have a connection. And don't be afraid to have that connection. What's going to happen is that the wins are going to be super sweet and the losses are going to be bitter, but it's an awesome way to live your life.
Wow, that is a great, optimistic, inspiring message for
entrepreneurs. That's the naive in me, Mike.
I was...
ignorant.
Yeah, well, we entrepreneurs look at things differently. We have a lens, you know, the rose-colored glasses or something, and we see things that other people don't. And, you know, that's what makes us do what, you know, what is statistically improbable. And I, even though I started this whole conversation with some negative comments about starting a business and the huge failure rate statistically, I think that huge failure rate really is not a result of how dangerous businesses are and how likely they are to fail. It's really the entrepreneurs themselves not knowing what they don't know. You know, they don't know what they don't know, and not picking up new skills and not adapting and not bringing in a team of people, you know, as smart or smarter than they are, you know, with skills they don't have. And I think if an entrepreneur is going to take that leap and start a business, then sure, the passion, the ego, the naivety, the arrogance, yeah, all that is important to, you know, I call that first gear, right? You can't start a car in fifth gear. You have to start a car in first gear, but you can't get up to speed in first gear. So that first gear is all those kind of nasty traits that just put blinders on you and force you to just go for it. And then you have to get savvy. Then you have to switch to second, third, fourth, fifth, et cetera, and leverage that transmission from starting the business to growing the business, to sustaining the business, all three separate skills, right?
Very separate skills.
And a lot of entrepreneurs get stuck on only one and then it fails. Yeah. And that is, you know, a statistical probability that it will fail if you can't shift gears. So I think in your business, in my business, I've been very fortunate to work with great people.
Absolutely.
And that's what allows us to go through the gears and get up to the, you know, sustainability mode after all these years. So Bill, thank you so much for being my guest today. This is a great conversation. I love talking with you. I wanted to talk to you for a while, and I'm glad I was able to pin you down and get on your schedule.
It was awesome. Thanks so much, Mike. And yeah, I can't believe it's been an hour already.
I know, it goes by fast, right? I used to do all the coding for our equipment, back in the day. I can't really call myself a coder, but I couldn't afford a coder, so I did all the coding for our early machines. And my wife would call it software time. You know, I'm writing code, and she'd go, "How much longer?" And I go, "I'll be done in an hour." And then literally like 7 hours later, it's like, "Has it been an hour?"
It's been an hour.
it's like dog ears, right? Exactly. It's crazy. Yeah. So I think just being in business does the same thing. I started my business 28 years ago, and it just seems like, in some ways, 28 months ago, you know, it's like yesterday. It just, time flies.
Yeah, keeps you fresh, right?
I guess time flies when you're having fun, right? This is the thrill ride.
It's
a thrill ride, complete with screams and you know, unexpected drops and all sorts of stuff. I'd like to call business a video game with different levels, right? So you start off with 5 lives, and then you pass your first level, and you have 2 lives left, and then you get to the third level and you have 1 life left, and there's more monsters and more trapdoors and more whatever, more peril. Business is that way. Every year it's like, you know, who would have thought in February that, you know, the next month we'd all be shut down?
I mean,
who would have thought that? Yeah. Oh, well, bring it on, right?
Bring it on, exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill, so much. I wish you, I don't think I need to, but continued success. I love the way you run your company and the novel approach you take to running that business. Thank you so much for being my guest, and stay safe, stay happy, stay healthy.
You too, Mike. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. A special thanks to Circuits Assembly Magazine and Ascendo Reliability for syndicating this show, and where you can listen to this and other interesting podcasts on PCBChat.com and Reliability.fm. Thanks for your questions and episode suggestions. Please keep them coming. Send comments to Mike@MikeConrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Reliability Matters. Once again, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.